All right. Thank you, Joe. For those of you who I have not met, my name is Karen Johnston. I'm a vascular neurologist at University of Virginia, and I chair the acute stroke working group with my colleague, Jeff Saver, who I think I saw over there. There he is. First of all, want to ask you to switch gears and start thinking again about acute trials. You're going to hear a lot of the same themes that you've already heard from the other two domains, but we want to think about them in terms of acute trials a little bit. And I will also thank all of you who responded to the survey. So what we're going to do is we're going to spend the entire time that we have, something around 30 to 45 minutes. I can keep it a little shorter because we've covered a lot. And I'm going to summarize the responses that you gave us on the survey, and then I just want to open it up for discussion. I have three kind of topics, but a lot of those topics we've kind of touched on. So if there are other topics related to acute trials, I want you to bring it. This is your last chance to talk about the domain-specific concepts. So you may remember that in the survey, in the acute part of the survey, we asked you six questions. And the first question was about what does success in the stroke net look like in 5 years through the lens of the acute trials. And these are the responses that we got. And like Humana, I kind of grouped them based on your responses. Overwhelmingly, you all talked about improved enrollment. And a lot of you talked about change in clinical practice, improving outcomes, improving the care that we offer to our patients. Lots of you, again, talked about simple, practical studies that are more generalizable, and we'll talk about that when we have the discussion. Balanced and diverse portfolios you brought up, not only across domains, but across diseases, across timeframes, and then administrative things, improved process, improved startup, data capture, timelines, et cetera. So that was the first question. The second question was about what are your biggest obstacles to reaching that success in the next cycle? And these, again, bunch together. The first one by far was inadequate financial resources. Now, we've talked a little bit about this today, and I love the fact that people are trying to problem solve this and prioritize how to spend their dollars. Honestly, the financial piece is beyond our scope. You're welcome to bring your solutions to some of this, but obviously we can't fix this issue of having lots more dollars. But one of the things that folks talked about was a lot about the need for 24/7 staff support for enrolling in acute trials and 24/7 pharmacy. So that's something I wanted to bring to the discussion if folks have more solutions. Participant recruitment and enrollment again came up as a major topic in terms of obstacles. And again, process issues, startup is an obstacle, administrative challenges, communication with sites, which I thought there was a beautiful discussion this morning, especially from our coordinators, about how we can maximize communication across sites. That again will come up in the discussion. And then stroke net process from concept to completion, a barrier. Okay. Then we ask you about what are the biggest unmet clinical care needs? And this is what we heard. We heard ICH and neuroprotection. Those are the two biggest things that we heard from you. We also heard about including underserved populations, stroke disparities. We're going to talk about that a little bit later. And other outcomes post-stroke. We talked about that a little bit with Steve Kramer's group this morning. That's an important one. Extended time windows, translational research process is a need. And then a whole bunch of specific kind of care approaches were mentioned. And then again, you all brought back the financial piece. And then we specifically, like the prevention group, asked the question about how do we more completely engage and include the rural and small hospitals in our enrollment approaches? And you guys came up with great technology solutions, lots of mention of telemedicine, remote supported enrollment, e-consent, which I know we talked about some, direct shipment of treatments and home visits. There was no mention in ours about the vans, but close. Lots of mention again about more funding. And we can talk about how we can prioritize our funding to support the small hospitals. Simple pragmatic trials came up again. These are recurrent themes in all the domains. And then lots of talk about collaboration and mentoring, creating that communication network and infrastructure across your sites. Okay, and then we ask you, how do you keep your teams engaged? Again, this comes back to that communication network that we talked about a little bit this morning. Lots of talk about ways to come together and share ideas, team meetings, workshops, forums, newsletters, sharing information, giving lots of kudos. Again, more funds was requested. And then reduced administrative burden across the teams. And then the last question we asked you was about how do we engage the pre-hospital systems more to potentially help us with the acute domain? And a lot of good ideas here, really engaging pre-hospital stakeholders in our on our StrokeNet teams, connecting with Siren, which I know we have some of our Siren leadership here. Siren, as you know, is much more focused on the emergency space. And that was a good idea, I thought, leveraging state and regional hospital systems, mobile stroke units, highlighting pre-hospital successes. How often do we actually give kudos to the pre-hospital team? And also offering tools and resources that make the pre-hospital team's role in research easier. And then again, you brought up financial resources. I heard you. There's a lot about the finances, and then lots more about collaboration. So that's just an overarching summary. I wanted to go through that quickly because I want to have time for discussion. So we have three discussion topics. We'll get to the third one if we have time. But the first two are about small and rural satellite hospitals. I want to think out loud again about what do we actually do? What do we start tomorrow? Or where do we work with the coordinating centers about changing tomorrow? What can we do to support our small rural satellite hospitals? The second question will be about simple pragmatic trials, which we've talked about a little bit. And then the third, if we have time, about recruitment and enrollment. So if we go to the question of how do we support our small and rural satellite hospitals, and I hope that we have some of them in the room and the coordinators in the room, I hope we will hear from you. But this is just one quote that really struck me as an important concept to keep in mind. This was somebody listed as an obstacle. The current finances of hospitals post-COVID means everyone is tightening their belts and personnel aren't stable. So there's not much extra money in the system to float stroke research outside of the RCCs. So with that in mind, what is the next step for us? How are we going to engage these small and more rural hospitals? Thoughts? Some folks talked about flipping the model. Has anybody thought about this and having the funds flow directly to the satellite hospitals first? There was a lot of talk about the finances and the way the structure is set up that is disadvantageous to the small and rural hospitals. Yeah.
Anyway, has a comment in the chat. It says, okay, we can't practically have 24/7 and successfully retain staff long-term. We need after hours and weekends, not 24/7, but both pharmacy and our enrolling teams.
Right. So how are folks managing that? A lot of your satellite hospitals probably don't have 24/7 teams for enrollment, including the investigational pharmacy. So how are you managing that? What are folks doing?
I missed the question you just asked, but I wanted to make a comment, which is, we did an analysis a while back now on our team and found that midnight to 6 a.m. was such a low yield situation that we've just routinely skipped that. And I wonder if we could be more upfront about that expectation to the point about after hours and weekends being more important, that might help people sort of focus more and stop thinking 24/7, but something a little more feasible.
Yeah, that's a nice compromise. Yeah.
Okay. Ricky Lena from the University of Iowa. So we deal with a lot of small rural hospitals there. And what he said, that comment is, I didn't write it, but it's totally true. There's no resources to do acute stroke research. So our best bet, what has been working for us, is to facilitate the transfer of these patients. And they're willing to consent patients in advance for trials through the air medical transport teams and by faxing the consent. So they have plenty of patients. They're willing to help us, but they just don't have the resources to start the interventions there. So I think the best bet is just to facilitate the transport and early consent of this institution.
Great. So in the acute trials, that can be an obstacle, right, to transfer unless you consent them before they transfer. So putting in the legwork to create a process for the consenting remotely and then transfer and then do the offer the interventions. Great idea.
I was going to echo Enrique's words, but I was going to also point out the fundamental business problem here is that you have large fixed costs. You have substantial variable costs, depending on the trial and its complexity. And you have a very small population with which to distribute that over at a rural hospital. And Enrique's solution is one thing. I would argue that our RCCs can develop the relationships that can mitigate some of the fixed cost, you know, the invested investigator or nurse manager who takes this project on as a element of moral good. What I see we have more problems with is the variable cost, the administrative burden of conducting these trials where a single small site may only put in 2 patients over 5 years. And we have to look thoughtfully at the variable cost that we can actually control. We can't really fix the fixed cost problem, but we can leverage our relationships to adjust that. It's the variable administrative burden cost that we can most impact.
Yeah, those are great comments. The other thing that I would ask maybe Enrique to comment on is once you transfer these patients, how do you do the follow-up? Because one of the other things that we heard routinely was that the follow-up burden for the patients, if they have to travel to the big house, is too much. And then we have retention issues, right? So how are you guys managing that?
Well, that is a problem, you know, and we tried. I think the clue is to minimize the return visits for acute trials and do as many as remote assessments as possible, particularly for that population. At least that's what has been working for us. But I want to emphasize that the thing of the consent is not only important, getting the consenting advance from these institutions is important because of the time issue, but also the relatives are usually there in the outside hospital. But they are not. They're not when they arrive to the hospital, at least initially. So that's what is so critical in order to enroll them in acute trials to get the consent up front.
Yeah, that's a really important point because often when the transfer comes, the patient has arrived, but they don't have capacity to give consent. And then you're searching for the family who might be en route, who are very hard to track down. That's a really good point. So I want to come back to something that was mentioned earlier about the community health workers and cooperative extension. For any of you who have cooperative extension, is anybody using those resources, those networks in your communities to get out to the rural hospitals? Is there an opportunity to leverage that? Because there are people out in the communities, in community health spaces. Is there an opportunity to bring them into research? So I would just put that out there. Yeah.
I'll address that quickly. First, at Columbia, there is an Institute for Community Health Workers that one of my colleagues is involved with, and it's not being put into a StrokeNet clinical trial yet, but I know that those resources are available, and I think it's an extremely important resource. We have experience with it in an urban setting, which is different from a rural setting, so it doesn't quite address that, but as a category, community health workers are invested in their community, coming from their community, communicate well with their community, and are just invaluable in communicating and getting buy-in for therapeutic advancing.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Randy. Cheryl, I'm glad you're at the mic.
So one of the other groups that could be leveraged is paramedicine or paramedical teams that do go out to the homes and could be involved in research. They often are involved in transition of care programs, for example, in certain rural communities in North Carolina. So that's another important
network
group. Yeah.
Yeah, great. That's great. So I'll just, I know we've talked about this a lot today, so I don't want to beat this to death, but I will say that nationally, there's a great deal of interest in these decentralized clinical trials. And in this third cycle of StrokeNet, it may be an opportunity for us to rethink the structure of how we're doing our clinical trials and maybe starting to use some of that. And telemedicine is one of the big components of these decentralized trials, right? So we're already doing that. But getting creative and starting to think about some of the ways that we can take our research to the patients, as opposed to asking all of the patients to come to us where we're doing our research. And that kind of takes us to the second question for discussion, which I know we've touched on throughout the morning, but the concept of how do we do more simple, pragmatic trials, and what are the pros and cons of that? So throughout the survey and all the domains, we heard this concept of it is really hard on our coordinator staff if the trials are really complicated, and that we could generalize our work more if the trials were more simple. Yeah, comment.
Aaron Lord from NYU. I think creating goals for StrokeNet would, you know, how many trials you would like to be pragmatic. And then I think we also need a good definition of, because I think this group has proved that they're very good at getting the goals done. So I think setting the goals would be great. And what is a pragmatic trial? I think setting definitions of what that is, how many hours of coordinator time is a pragmatic trial, and making sure that when it goes to study section, you know, well, these are the things that we're going to ask because we can only have an hour and a half of coordinator time for the study. So I think setting some goals and definitions would really help.
Yeah, I love that. And it comes back to the concept of this balanced portfolio, right? Like, I don't think anybody is suggesting that we move away from the, you know, the complex questions and complex designs completely, but that we have a balanced portfolio with some of these more pragmatic trials that we can take out to all of our sites. Yeah, Jeff.
One step is taking toward pragmatic trials is making it a registry-based trial using Get With The Guidelines Stroke, so that most of the fields in the case report form will be automatically populated from sites Get With The Guidelines Stroke registry. And we hope that that will become a process that can be used in other StrokeNet trials if it turns out to be useful. I'll also mention that it would be helpful perhaps for NINDS to issue a NOFO, if that's the current term, a notice of interest in pragmatic trials, because it's very hard for pragmatic trials to get through peer review, because peer reviewers want to see credible detail and great science and something that's simple and straightforward they can't keep their hands off of. So I think we need a protected route that a specific call would provide.
I love that. So two concepts there. One is that we have to think about the peer review process and how we're going to make sure that study section recognizes the importance and the role of some of these. And then the other point that I thought was a really good one, Jeff, is that the STEP platform is coming, and we hopefully will be able to learn from what happens at the STEP platform if that registry approach really works in the STEP platform. Even though only certain sites will be participating early in the STEP platform, maybe we can roll some of those out to all of the RCCs, all of the satellite sites in some way. Maybe that's an opportunity to start thinking about that now, so that as we learn from STEP, we can generalize that very quickly. So good thoughts. Yeah, Brett.
Yeah, two perspectives. Brett Meyer, UCSD. The first is what I'm going to refer to as the RCC network sites perspective. And I put myself in their mind and I say, how come I have so many sites and only some of them can participate? And where do I lose them? I usually lose them when they review the concept synopsis or the protocol or something, and they get through and they go, oh, great molecule, great this, great that. Oh, PK at 2 hours, out, I'm out. Or, you know, oh, I have to do this complicated evaluation of cognitive function at 4 days and 400 days and 400 minutes and 12, I'm out. You know, usually there's an I'm out moment. Mm-hmm. And I look at these sites that are fantastic and I go, wait, you're a great interventional site. Why aren't you participating in this trial? I'm out. Or you're a great prevention site. Why aren't you participating in this trial? I'm out. It's usually because not how many hours is it going to take for my coordinator or my provider, but when are those hours and, you know, how onerous are those hours? And it just, the I'm out moment is the part of the pragmatic, simple trial that I really think we need to focus on. The second piece is what Jeff mentioned, but just in a different perspective. And that is, I think our problem is ourselves. You know, we have great intentions of doing pragmatic trials until we, you know, I've written a couple, you know, they start out real simple. They get to a working group and then they, something gets added and another thing gets added and another perspective gets added and then a PK gets added. And then, oh, but you're going to want to do this complicated outcome design. And then eventually maybe we get to study section. I'm not even worried about study section. I'd love the NOFO for study section to say that, but I think we're our own problem where we are getting excited by the shiny penny moment. And the shiny penny moment is going to kill us. We have to start simple and stay simple as we go through each of these steps. And when someone says, yeah, but let's add, we all need to say, yeah, but no, because I got 200 sites that I want to be able to do this trial, not two.
Love that. So a couple things that I heard, Brett. Number one is that the acute working group has a role in this. And so maybe there's a pathway that we could create, and we can talk about this, about if something can flag, something can come in and be flagged as a pragmatic approach, and it is intended to stay pragmatic. And the other thing I thought about as you were talking is, where are our satellite sites represented on the acute stroke working group to say, wait, 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 this is my I'm out moment. As soon as you do that complicated thing, I can tell you that my site and 200 sites like me will not be able to participate. Maybe that's a voice we need in the acute stroke.
We don't know what those comments are. We don't need everyone represented. We just need to hold ourselves to the barometer of this is an I'm out moment.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great comment. Yeah, Scott.
So just, I want to echo because I thought what Brett just said was very brilliant, because I do think in this whole conversation, we're creating our own enemies. It's not the review. It's not the NOFO. The NOFO actually endorses and calls for pragmatic studies. You know, review is receptive of the idea. Clarity was very well received as a simple pragmatic study, you know, on the first round. So I agree with this. I mean, we can solve the problems on this by just sort of creating a pathway. But I would very much support and urge you to think about that.
I like the idea of having some kind of cue to the working group that this is intended to be pragmatic and stay pragmatic, so that we as a group in review can stay in that space and work toward that. So I really like that comment. Other comments? Yes, Cheryl.
Yeah. So I want to speak as someone who's actually been funded and completed a pragmatic trial through PCORI. And there are a number of different appealing things to it. One is that you can, with this large network, you can randomize hospitals, you can randomize a network potentially to all do a particular type of intervention once trained, and then be able to compare it across the national network. So that's one opportunity. And the main thing is just the downside is just being able to collect the outcomes to answer the question, which some people have alluded to before. But I can tell you that you have to take the time to train the people who are doing the intervention to make sure it gets done in real world practice. That's a challenge. But then you have to be able to collect the outcomes to be able to answer the question. And at each point, you drop off in your sample size.
Yeah, important. It's not that a pragmatic trial necessarily is an easy trial. It's just different complexity, different pain points, right?
Yeah, just wanted to kind of tag on to Cheryl's comment there too, is when we say pragmatic trial, that can mean very different things. Pragmatism can happen at different stages of trials, from design to participants to organization to delivery to outcomes to analysis. And I just feel like when we're designing the trial, maybe just paying explicit attention to each of these steps. Not everything has to be pragmatic. I don't think there are many trials who have been pragmatic to that level using PRECIS tool and things like that. But just paying attention to if we can be pragmatic at each stage, that'll be helpful.
Yeah, I love that.
Dr. Johnson? I also think we could think about combination trials where we have a large part of it being very simplified, where you can get lots of sites and lots of people, and then build a second tier in where the sites that are capable of handling the more complex could be doing the more subgroup kinds of data collection that allows for some of those other more complicated answers.
Yeah, so this is kind of the flip of what we heard earlier, which is maybe middle phase would do the complex stuff and the phase three would be the simple. This is kind of the opposite, where everybody does the simple and then the subgroups do the more complicated. So some good ideas.
Enrique, later from my work, you know, it's very exciting to hear everything about the pragmatic trials, because it seems like we all want it. You know, we're having all these problems that, and why, rather than compensating, like you're saying, flagging the trial as pragmatic, let's protect it because it's pragmatic. Why not just scoring trials more for being pragmatic? Because pragmatism goes to feasibility and recruitment, totally. Right?
And so generalizability, right?
So
like
the blue
impact.
And red lines don't diverge so much. Yeah. So why not even scoring them additionally, or having a category for pragmatism in a clinical trial?
Yeah, it's a good message to the working groups, right? Because we do tend to get kind of into the weeds and look for deeper science and more information. And so if we can change the culture to be very not only welcoming of a more pragmatic approach, but encouraging when these complex concepts come through to think more pragmatically, we can change the culture of the whole stroke net. So yeah, I think you're right. I think we just may need a little help to get started.
Yeah, I just don't want to dilute that it's a one size fits all.
Great.
And I don't want to kind of like convey that, you know, just because it's pragmatic and it's simple, that review is going to like it better. That's not what I intended to say when I came up before. I mean, I think there are situations that make the most sense, and there are situations that don't. And that's what we kind of think. I think the other way of thinking of it, right, is how do we reduce the number of steps or reduce the barriers? You know, it seems like we go out of our way, and that, I mean, government is terrible at this, at creating more steps to get something done. You know, and what we ought to be looking at is how we can take some of those steps away. That will streamline a lot of what we're talking about.
Yep.
But not everything is going to fit a pragmatic question.
Totally agree. But I think broadening our portfolio to have some pragmatic trials is clearly what we heard is an ask from StrokeNet overall. Yeah.
I think Eva Mistry again, I think Scott exactly said what the point was I was trying to make as a PI for phase two novelytic trial. I just don't want to focus to kind of go away that for new therapies, explanatory trials that have some extra PK/PD studies that are required by FDA, you cannot not have them, is necessary. I mean, it's great to have pragmatism. And I think when we design phase two studies, it's good to think through all of those steps and instill pragmatism as the degree that we can, but we have to have explanatory trials for science to kind of move forward as well.
Totally agree. And that's why I liked the thought earlier about the middle phase or phase two trials gathering that complex data. Because once we have proof of concept and feasibility at the phase two stage, why wouldn't we want to be already thinking about implementation by keeping the design of the phase three trial simple enough that it would be generalizable as a trial and then generalizable as treatment, right? So it might be a nice in-between step to think about the early implementation science when we're designing those phase three trials. Yeah.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that, you know, NIDS has to be a good steward of taxpayer money, right? So another way to look at it is, can this be done pragmatically? That's something that
yes.
the Institute is kind of charged with thinking about. When we see an application or a concept, we have to think, you know, is a $70 million trial the best way to get the answer to this particular set of questions?
Yeah, and then a follow on that is, again, if we do spend $70 million just doing it in select hospitals, how generalizable is it? And how much impact are we going to have if it's not generalizable, right? So that, but I like that point that there are certain topics that are going to allow pragmatic trials and others that likely won't. Yeah, Brett.
Sorry, Brett Meyer, UCSD again. I just want to emphasize sort of Eva's point and give a shout out to Sister for exactly my point, which is, you know, when we have some of these sites that are so close to being able to do some of these trials and they read a protocol and they say there's a PK at 4 hours, wait, it's 3 hours. I could do 3 hours or I could do 2 hours, but 5 hours, I can't do because my staff has already left. these little moments that I know Sister, because we've talked about it, have paid quite a bit of attention to, hey, is this a practical thing? Can I get a PK done at 3 hours instead of four? Because it makes a difference.
Yep.
And so big shout out to Sister for paying attention to those pragmatic issues. And I would sort of say that when we design these trials, those things should be thought of right away. You know, can I do a 2 hour PK, or does it have to be six? Those kind of things.
Yeah.
So thank you to Sister.
And thinking about those pain points early, I think is key, right? During the design phase.
Just one comment. Just remember, it is a balance. And I love pragmatic studies and in the questions, but TPA, and I would say endovascular, doesn't happen if we are doing things that are practical and pragmatic and the usual thing that we do. So we, in our network, we have to balance what is new and what is groundbreaking with what is something that's also can change the way we practice. And we need to ask a question. So I think the takeaway from this is the review group needs to really have some specific questions, not just in acute, but prevention and recovery too, of what's practical, maybe instead of pragmatic, what's practical, what fits in the workflow. And if you have to do something outside of workflow, why, and have a really good reason that the patient understands it, who's on the committee, and that the other people on the committee understand it.
Yeah, that's great. In the interest of time, I'm going to move to the third topic to see if there are still more comments that we want to think about related to this. But this is about recruitment and enrollment. So very clearly, we heard your voices about the fact that your vision for success for the future of StrokeNet is to improve our recruitment and enrollment. So thinking in a very focused way, are there specific pain points that folks want to bring up that we should be prioritizing, especially for acute trials, but potentially for all trials, that we should be thinking about together? And I just pulled this one quote. We've already talked a little bit about these concepts, but this really resonated with me. It said, the difficulty is in enrolling patients for acute trials at a faster pace. Not all centers are set up to recruit acute stroke trials, as it requires significant support from the emergency department and 24/7 in-house research team presence. So we heard from Pooja, maybe it's not quite 24/7. We talked a little bit about engaging with our pre-hospital teams. Could that help? What are the other pain points that folks are thinking about? We've heard a lot about investigational pharmacy. That feels to me like a pain point. What are your other pain points for acute recruitment in cycle three of StrokeNet? Looking for my coordinator friends.
Getting consent.
Getting consent. Talk about
the
ability
to do remote consent of family members who may not be able to be at that hospital.
Yeah. So how many people are doing e-consent routinely now? So not everyone, a lot of people. That has changed the field a lot, right? I feel like that COVID really accelerated that. But those types of things, we need to make sure that we have that option, right?
Yeah. I'm going to go back to team engagement. If the coordinators are not notified, you cannot enroll.
Yeah. Yeah. So the conversation this morning about the communication strategies across teams really surprised me. I actually would have expected that the more structured approach would have worked better, but I clearly heard that a more comfortable, casual communication network across teams may be the way to go. So every team is different. So you can all figure this out for your own teams, but give yourself permission to try different strategies to maximize communication, both at enrollment, before enrollment, after enrollment, in between. Yeah.
Yeah, Chris Tribe from the University of Minnesota again. You know, I saw this quote, and I do think this is important. This is what we are working on sort of with the Telestroke advisory group. And it's really sort of remote research. If we have an enrollment overnight, we would enroll them over Telestroke, and we would see that patient on Telestroke anyway. So that's not really a change of practice for the team that's taking care of the patient. And we wouldn't go in, and if we did have to go in, our numbers would go down pretty significantly. One, just because you're not going to get there fast enough, right? If you're driving in to see a patient and you have 60 minutes to enroll them from the time they show up, you're really not going to be able to do it. I think the other part about it is just that probably 50% of our acute enrollments now are remote in some way, whether it's e-consent because the family's not present, so you don't have very much time, so you're doing the remote part, or the consent part is remote, you're taking care of the patient in person, but maybe the person who's giving consent is not there, is done remotely, you know, we are not in-house, or sometimes, again, the patient is distant, and so we aren't enrolling the patient, whereas we're in-house, but they're not there. And again, you know, this doubles our enrollment when we looked at it, and this is data from a few years ago. It's actually probably even higher now. And I think that this is something that we hope to try to bring to StrokeNet. There's other members of the advisory group that's here. There's a lot of sites here that do this really well. I learned it at UPMC, is where I started. And so I think that you know, hopefully this is something that can come to the network. We're happy to advise, and we do get input from StrokeNet in terms of, you know, how can we help sort of spread and teach the practice. And then just some other comments that have come up before, the protocols have to allow it. I mean, there are protocols that don't even allow remote consent, and you know, we see patients and we can enroll them, but we are not allowed to by the protocol. And that's mostly changed, but we do hope to see that, you know, really standardized for trials that are coming through. Thanks.
Yeah, this feels like a big step toward that decentralized clinical trials approach, is having an expert team that can help all of our sites think about whether there are opportunities like this. Yeah.
Excellent. Ken Reginald from Cleveland. I envy Chris's setup where everything is remote, and I thought the e-consent was standard across you know, StrokeNet now. So I think some of these remote consent through e-consent should be feasible. But I think beyond that, then sort of the reality, you know, at his place, it looks like people can cross institutions and provide, you know, and do the, you know, if it needs to be in person, it can be done. But you know, that's not the case here. And then sort of you know, the pharmacy investigation, pharmacy being at the remote subject, who hangs it? Then sort of, you know, is the nurse comfortable giving an investigation drug at that site? And to be able to do that all hours, not, you know, excluding certain, you know, midnight to, we also exclude the 11 p.m. to 6 a.m., but still, you know, the daytime hour, the remote site, how to get these patients recruited, you know, practically, it's still challenging.
Yep, and every site is different, and I hear you on that. Yeah, come in here and then come over there.
Abby Segaitis, the University of Minnesota. I wanted to actually touch on the 24/7 in-house research team presence, because I don't think that necessarily has to be the case. I know one of the things that, you know, it is really important to have great oversight over what's happening with consent or the intervention, but it doesn't necessarily have to be in-house, and it doesn't necessarily have to be with the same person. One of the things that that we've been doing for a number of trials, not just stroke trials, but other acute trials, is divvying up some of those, especially for the acute trials, the hyperacute trials. It is very challenging for one person to manage sending consent, receiving it, looking at it, all the inclusion, exclusion, randomization, coordinating with the team. That's a really difficult thing for one person to do. We actually have a team that does it, and they do it remotely. And I know that's come up a lot, but we also use that for training purposes. So if someone's new and they haven't seen enrolled before, we have them hop on our Zoom call for training purposes. So it's very practical to be able to divvy out the work in real time, so multiple people can do things in parallel and shave off a lot of that time. It also helps us reduce errors. It's not one person that is trying to manage a bunch of competing things. And just anecdotally, it's really helped us be able to retain staff that said, I do want a work-life balance. I'm willing to help you in my pajamas at home at 10 o'clock on a Friday, but I don't want to have to drive in. I won't even get there in time. So we've been really able to expand our team that way by allowing and incorporating remote. We do try to get people on the ground, you know, boots on the ground, but maybe expanding the way we think about how we're conducting those and doing things in parallel. And to speak to the pain points, we did a survey. Thank you to all the project managers who sent out the survey to their sites about workflow and who does different things in the workflow. And one of the interesting things we got back was that we had 76 sites respond. And of those 76 respondents, 58% had one single solidary coordinator for all their acute trials when there were other options. So that was clearly, you know, stood out to us as a pain point. But the bright light in this question was that we asked a number of different ways people collaborate and pool. Yes. And so there were a number of, some people collaborate among just their stroke trials. They have enough stroke trials, they can do that, or even their neurosciences center. Other people pooled resources with different acute trials. So there's a number of ways that people are successfully doing this. And it would be nice to have examples of those in a menu so we can disseminate that to more sites. So there is hope within this, and it is possible.
Yeah, I love your comments about the collaboration across the team. And we know that that retention of research coordinators is better when they feel like they're part of a community. So I love this example. Thank you. Great. I'm just going to kind of summarize your comment for the microphone so that our folks can hear.
3 minutes, Karen.
I'll wrap up. You're saying that the group that is taking call is taking less call because it's not a single person on every night. And when they do get the call that there's a potential candidate, they can almost always enroll. So it's a system that really works for you guys. So we appreciate that. Okay. Last comment, Drew, you sure?
Can I just have a couple comments from the chat? Dr. Adeo, yes. Dr. Adeoway was earlier agreeing with Colin's earlier statement about the inclusivity of the coordinators and the support of working together as a team. And then back to pragmatism, it's from Colin Dearden. It says maybe explicitly suggesting adding pragmatism to the novelty innovation for NIH review stage.
Great, great, great comments. Okay, in the last minute.
Go ahead. From UVA. One thing that struck me as I was listening is there any potential for cross-scanner off-hour support? In other words, people were talking about supervision. Mm-hmm. So could there be, and I don't think that necessarily we have to be borne by a single study that, you know, could we have people in California who are up until midnight being able to help people who are on until 3 a.m. on the East Coast, et cetera?
Yeah, I think as this model develops from our telestroke working group experts, that we may start thinking more broadly instead of a team that is just at your site collaborating and sharing call. Could we broaden that and have a larger pool, less call, lots of expertise across the pool? So I totally agree with that. Okay, I'm going to spend the last minute just summarizing for you the survey results for the acute research priority. So you remember that we gave you a long list of potential research topics that we should be focusing on in this next cycle. And these are your results. I will tell you that the top five things clustered at the top, they were almost all exactly in the same place. But what you told us your priorities are medical treatment for ICH, surgical treatment for ICH, medical treatment for subarachnoid, and neuroprotection, both prior to reperfusion and after reperfusion. So again, my thanks to everybody who filled out the survey. Appreciate everybody's time and great conversation.
Well done. Robust discussion. Thank you, Karen. Bernadette, Leslie, Georgia.